A Tree in a Forest, a collection of Ajahn Chah's similes, compiled and edited by Dhamma Garden Translation Group, Revised Edition. Ajahn Chah. Ajahn Chah was born in 1918 in a village located in the northeastern part of Thailand. He became a novice at a young age and received higher ordination at the age of 20. He followed the austere forest tradition for years, living in forests and begging for alms food as he wandered about on mendicant pilgrimage. He practiced meditation under a number of masters, among whom was Ajahn Mun, a highly respected and accomplished meditation teacher of the time. Ajahn Mun had an indelible influence on Ajahn Chah, giving his meditation practice the direction and clarity that it lacked. Ajahn Chah later became an accomplished teacher in his own right, sharing his realization of the Dhamma with those who sought it. The essence of his teaching was rather simple. Be mindful, don't hang on to anything. Let go and surrender to the way things are. Ajahn Chah passed away in peace after a long bout of illness on January 16, 1992, at his home monastery, Wat Pat Phong, in Ubon Ratchathani. A Tree in a Forest, a collection of Ajahn Chah's similes, compiled and edited by Dhamma Garden Translation Group, Dhamma Cultivation Publishing House. This book is for free distribution. Offer the gift of Dhamma to others as freely as it has been offered to you. Following the wish of Ajahn Chah that his Dhamma teachings not be sold in any way or form, this book is published for free distribution only. Copyright Dhamma Garden 1994. First printing 1994, second printing 1995, third printing 1996. Printed in Taiwan, Republic of China. A Tree in a Forest. People have asked about my practice. How do I prepare my mind for meditation? There is nothing special. I just keep it where it always is. They ask, then are you an arahant? Do I know? I am like a tree in a forest, full of leaves, blossoms, and fruit. Birds come to eat and nest, and animals seek rest in its shade, yet the tree does not know itself. It follows its own nature. It is as it is. Three new similes have been included in this revised edition of A Tree in a Forest: Dog's Leg, Idle Worker, and Raising Cows and Chickens. Foreword. The teachings of Ajahn Chah were originally made available to the English-speaking public by the efforts of his Western disciples, who were able to translate from Thai or Lao, the languages that Ajahn Chah taught in. Although for some time now these English publications have been circulating in Chinese-speaking communities, particularly in Singapore and Malaysia, and more recently in Taiwan, they have remained accessible only to those with an adequate knowledge of the English language. These readers, inspired by Ajahn Chah's teachings, have often expressed regret that those among their compatriots with little or no knowledge at all of the English shouldn't have the chance to benefit from the wisdom of Ajahn Chah's words. For this reason, a joyfully willing and dedicated group made up of members from both the Buddhist monastic community and laity decided to translate the words of Ajahn Chah. They came from Taiwan, Hong Kong, Singapore, and Malaysia, and all are blessed with the facility to work in both the English and Chinese languages. Also, and more importantly, they all have adequate experience and understanding of the Dhamma, coupled with the feel and genuine appreciation of Ajahn Chah's teachings. It is a credit to their goodness and sincere wish to spread the Dhamma in whatever way they can that this work is now in your hands. We would like to acknowledge gratitude to all who took part in any aspect of the production of this book, be it designing, proofreading, copying, contributing toward the cost of its printing, and so on. May the light of the triple gem continue to shine in their hearts and give them the peace and happiness they deserve. You will note that no one's name has been mentioned and none given any special credit. This is just a way of following Ajahn Chah's teaching of not trying to be anything, not an arahant, not a bodhisattva, nothing, not even a translator, a disciple. Introduction. Ajahn Chah reminded us that the Buddha himself could only point the way and could not do the practice for us, because the truth is something that cannot be put into words or given away. All the teachings Ajahn Chah taught are merely similes and comparisons, means to help the mind see the truth. If we establish the Buddha within our mind, then we see everything. We contemplate everything as no different from ourselves. Many of the similes that Ajahn Chah himself used to teach came out of his vast experience of living in the forest. His practice was simply to watch, all the while being totally open and aware of everything that was happening both inside and outside himself. He would say that his practice was nothing special. He was, in his own words, like a tree in a forest. A tree is as it is, he'd say. And Ajahn Chah was as he was. But out of such nothing specialness came a profound understanding of himself and the world. Ajahn Chah used to say, "The Dhamma is revealing itself in every moment, but only when the mind is quiet can we understand what it is saying, for the Dhamma teaches without words." Ajahn Chah had this uncanny ability to take that wordless Dhamma and convey its truth to his listeners in the form of a simile that was fresh, easy to follow, sometimes humorous, sometimes poetic, but always striking a place in the heart where would jar or inspire the most. We are like maggots. Life is like a falling leaf. Our mind is like rainwater. The teachings of Ajahn Chah teem with similes and comparisons like these. We thought it would be a good idea to collect them all in the form of a book as a source of inspiration for those who may want some respite from the heat of the world and seek some rest in the cool and abundant shade of a tree in the forest. These similes have been gleaned from the following publications: Bodhijnana, A Taste of Freedom, Our Real Home, Samabhivavana, Living Dhamma, Food for the Heart, A Still Forest Pool, and from a recently published book entitled Venerable Father, A Life with Ajahn Chah, that was written by Paul Bretter, editor. Part 1. We have to talk about the Dhamma like this, using similes, because the Dhamma has no form. Is it square or is it round? You can't say. The only way to talk about it is through similes like these. Ajahn Chah. Aimless wanderer. When we have no real home, we're like an aimless wanderer out on the road, going this way for a while and then that way, stopping for a while and then setting off again, until we return to our real home. Whatever we do, we feel ill at ease, just like somebody who's left his village to go on a journey. Only when he gets home again can he really relax and be comfortable. Nowhere in the world is any real peace to be found. That's the nature of the world. Look within yourself and find it there instead. When we think of the Buddha and how truly he spoke, we feel how worthy he is of reverence and respect. Whenever we see the truth of something, we see his teachings, even if we've never actually practiced Dhamma. But even if we have knowledge of his teachings, have studied and practiced them, but still not have seen their truth, then we're still homeless, like the aimless wanderer. Banana peel. When you see things in the world like a banana peels that have no great value to you, then you're free to walk in the world without being moved, without being troubled, without being hurt in any way by all the various kinds of things that come and pass away, whether pleasant or unpleasant. This is the path that leads you to freedom. Blind man. Both the body and mind are constantly arising and ceasing. Conditions are in a state of constant turmoil. The reason we can't see this in line with the truth is because we keep believing the untrue. It's like being guided by a blind man. How can we travel with him in safety? A blind man will only lead us into forests and thickets. How could he lead us to safety when he can't see? In the same way, our mind is deluded by conditions, creating suffering in the search for happiness, creating difficulty in the search for peace. Such a mind can have only problems and suffering. Really, we want to get rid of suffering and difficulty, but instead we create those very things. All we can do is complain. We create bad causes, and the reason we do so is because we don't know the truth of appearances and conditions and try to cling to them. bottle of medicine. We can compare practice to a patient who does not take the medicine that his doctor has left for him. Although detailed instructions have been written on the bottle, all the patient does is read them and doesn't actually take the medicine. If this is all he does, he is bound to die because he will gain no benefit from the medicine. And before he dies, he may complain bitterly that the doctor wasn't any good, that medicine didn't cure him. He may think the doctor was a fake or that medicine was worthless. Yet he had only spent his time examining the bottle and reading its instructions instead of actually taking the medicine. If he had followed the doctor's advice, however, and taken the medicine regularly as prescribed, he would have recovered. Doctors prescribe medicine to eliminate diseases from the body. The teachings of the Buddha are prescribed to cure diseases of the mind and to bring it back to its natural, healthy state. So the Buddha can be considered to be a doctor who prescribes cures for the illnesses of the mind, which are found in each one of us without exception. When you see these illnesses of the mind, does it not make sense to look to Dhamma as support, as medicine to cure your illnesses? Child playing. When we have contemplated the nature of the heart many times, we will come to understand that the heart's ways are just as they are and can't be otherwise. They make up the nature of the heart. If we see this clearly, then we can detach from thoughts and feelings. And we don't have to add on anything more if we constantly tell ourselves that that's just the way it is. When the heart truly understands, it lets go of everything. Thinking and feeling will still be there, but that very thinking and feeling will be deprived of power. It's like at first being annoyed by a child who likes to play in ways that annoy us so much that we scold or spank him. But later we understand that it's natural for a child to play and act like that. So we leave him alone. We let go and our troubles are over. Why are they over? Because now we accept the natural ways of children. Our outlook has changed, and we now accept the true nature of things. We let go and our heart becomes more peaceful. We now have right understanding. Cobra. Mental activity is like a deadly, poisonous cobra. If we don't interfere with a cobra, it simply goes its own way. Even though it may be extremely poisonous, we are not affected by it. We don't go near it or take hold of it, and so it doesn't bite us. The cobra does what is natural for a cobra to do. That's the way it is. If you are clever, you'll leave it alone. Likewise, you let be that which is not good. You let it be according to its own nature. You also let be that which is good. Don't grab at liking and disliking, just as you wouldn't grab at the cobra. One who is clever will have this kind of attitude toward the various moods that arise in his mind. When goodness arises, we let it be good. We understand its nature. In the same way, we let be the not good. We let it be according to its nature. We don't take hold of it because we don't want anything. We don't want evil. We don't want good. We don't want heaviness nor lightness, happiness nor suffering. When our wanting is at an end, peace is firmly established. Coconut shells. Desire is a defilement, but we must first have desire in order to start practicing the way. Suppose you want to buy coconuts at the market, and while carrying them back home, someone asked, "Why did you buy those coconuts?" "I bought them to eat," you reply. "Are you going to eat the shells too?" "Of course not." "I don't believe you," he insists. "If you're not going to eat the shells, then why did you buy them?" "Well, what do you say? How are you going to answer that question?" We practice with desire to begin with. If we didn't have desire, we wouldn't practice. Contemplating in this way can give rise to wisdom, you know. For example, those coconuts. Are you going to eat the shells as well? Of course not. Then why do you take them? They're useful for wrapping up the coconuts in. If, after eating the coconuts, you throw the shells away, there is no problem. Our practice is the same. We keep desire first, just like we do with coconut shells. For it's still not time to throw it away. This is how practice is. If somebody wants to accuse us of eating coconut shells, that's their business. We know what we're doing. Cooking. At first, we train the body and speech to be free of unwholesomeness. This is virtue. Some people think that to have virtue, you must memorize Pali phrases and chant all day and night. But really, all you have to do is make your body and speech blameless. And that's virtue. It's not so difficult to understand. It's just like cooking food. Put in a little bit of this and a little bit of that until it's just right and it's delicious. And once it's delicious, you don't have to put anything else into it. That the right ingredients have already been added. In the same way, taking care that our actions and speech are proper will give us delicious virtue, virtue that is just right. Crazy man. Suppose one morning you're walking to work and a man starts yelling insults at you. As soon as you hear his insults, your mind gets agitated. You don't feel so good. You feel angry and hurt, and you want to get even. A few days later, another man comes to your house and tells you, "Hey, that man who abused you the other day, he's crazy. Had been for years. He abuses everybody like that. Nobody takes notice of anything he says." As soon as you hear this, you are suddenly relieved. That anger and hurt that you pent up within you all these days melt away completely. Why? Because now you know the truth. Before, you didn't. You thought the man was normal. So you were angry at him, and that caused you to suffer. As soon as you found out the truth, however, everything changed. Oh, he's mad. That explains everything. When you understand the truth, you feel fine because you know for yourself. Understanding, you can then let go. If you don't know the truth, you cling right there. When you thought the man who abused you was normal, for example, you could have killed him. But when you found out the truth that he was mad, you felt much better. This is knowledge of the truth. Someone who sees the Dhamma has a similar experience. When attachment, aversion, delusion disappear, they disappear in the same way. As long as we don't know these things, we think, "What can I do? I have so much greed and aversion." This is not clear knowledge. It's just the same as when we thought the madman was sane. When we finally saw that he was mad all along, we were relieved of hurt and anger. Only when the mind sees for itself can it uproot and relinquish attachment. Cup of water. Many of those who come to see me have a high standing in the community. Among them are merchants, college graduates, teachers, and government officials. Their minds are filled with opinions about things. They are too clever to listen to others. It is like a cup of water. If a cup is filled with stale, dirty water, it is useless. Only after the old cup has been thrown out can the cup again become useful. You must empty your minds of opinions. Then you will see. Our practice goes beyond cleverness and stupidity. If you think that you are clever, wealthy, important, or an expert in Buddhism, you cover up the truth of non-self, and all you see is self, I and mine. But Buddhism is letting go of self. Those who are too clever will never learn. They must first get rid of their cleverness, first empty their cup. Damn. The training in concentration is the practice to make the mind firm and steady. This brings about peacefulness of mind. Usually our minds are moving and restless, hard to control. The mind follows sense distractions wildly, just like water flowing this way and that. Men, though, know how to control water so that it is of greater use to mankind. Men are clever. They know how to dam water, make large reservoirs and canals. All of this merely to channel water and make it more usable, so that it doesn't run wild and eventually settle down into a few low spots, its usefulness wasted. So too, the mind, which is dammed and controlled, trained constantly, will be of immeasurable benefit. The Buddha himself taught, "The mind that has been controlled brings true happiness, so train your minds well for the highest benefits." Similarly, the animals we see around us, elephants, horses, buffaloes, and so on, must be trained before they can be useful for work. Only after they have been trained in their strength of benefit to us. In the same way, the mind that has been trained will bring many times the blessings of that of an untrained mind. The Buddha and his noble disciples all started out in the same way with us, with untrained minds. But afterwards, look how they became the subjects of reverence for us all. And see how much benefit we can gain from their teachings. Indeed, see what benefits have come to the entire world from these men who had gone through the training of the mind to reach the freedom beyond. The mind controlled and trained is better equipped to help us in all professions, in all situations. The disciplined mind will keep our lives balanced, make work easier, and develop and nurture reason to govern our actions. In the end, our happiness will increase accordingly as we follow the proper mind training. Deep hole. Most people just want to perform good deeds to make merit, but they don't want to give up wrongdoing. It's just that the hole is too deep. Suppose there was a hole and there was something at the bottom of it. Now anyone who put his hand into the hole didn't reach the bottom would say the hole was too deep. If 100 or 1,000 people put their hands down in that hole, they'd all say, "The hole is too deep." No one would say that his arm was too short. We have to come back to ourselves. We have to take a step back and look at ourselves. Don't blame the hole for being so deep. Turn around and look at your own arm. If you can see this, then you will make progress on the spiritual path and will find happiness. Dirty clothes. It is only natural that when our body is dirty and we put on dirty clothes, that our mind too will feel uncomfortable and depressed. However, if we keep our body clean and wear clean, neat clothes, it makes our mind light and cheerful. So too, when morality is not kept, our bodily actions and speech are dirty, and this is a cause for making the mind unhappy, uncomfortable, and distressed. We are separated from right practice, and this prevents us from penetrating into the essence of the Dhamma in our mind. The wholesome bodily actions and speech themselves depend on the mind properly trained, since mind orders body and speech. Therefore, we must continue to practice by training our mind. Drinking glass. How can you find right understanding? I can answer you simply by using this glass of water I am holding. It appears to us as clean and useful, something to drink from and keep for a long time. Right understanding is to see this as broken glass, as if it has already been shattered. Sooner or later, it will be shattered. If you keep this understanding while you are using it, then all it is a combination of elements which come together in this form and then break apart. Then no matter what happens to the glass, you will have no problem. The body is like the glass. It is also going to break apart and die. You have to understand that. Yet when you do, it doesn't mean you should go and kill yourself, just as you shouldn't take the glass and break it or throw it away. The glass is something to use until it falls apart in its own natural way. In the same way, the body is a vehicle to use until it goes its own way. Your task is to see what the natural way of things is. This understanding can make you free in all the changing circumstances of the entire world. Drunk. Anyone attached to the senses is like a drunk whose liver is not yet cooked. He does not know when he has had enough. He continues to indulge and drink carelessly. He's caught badly and later suffers illness and pain. Duck. Your practice is like raising a duck. Your duty is to feed it and give it water. If the duck grows fast or slow is its business, not yours. Let it go and just do your own work. Your business is to practice. If it's fast or slow, just know it. Don't try to force it. This kind of practice has a good foundation. Empty space. People want to go to Nibbana, but when you tell them that there is nothing there, they begin to have second thoughts. But there's nothing there, nothing at all. Look at the roof and floor here. Think of the roof as a becoming and the floor as a becoming too. You can stand on the roof and you can stand on the floor, but in the empty space between the roof and the floor, there is no place to stand. Where there is no becoming, that's where there's emptiness. And to put it bluntly, we say that Nibbana is this emptiness. They don't want to go. They're afraid that they won't see their children or relatives. That's why whenever we bless the laity by wishing them long life, beauty, happiness, and strength, they become very happy. However, if we start talking about letting go and about emptiness, they don't want to hear about it. But have you ever seen a very old person with a beautiful complexion or a lot of strength or a lot of happiness? No, but we wish them long life, beauty, happiness, and strength, and they are all pleased. They're attached to becoming, to the cycle of birth and death. They prefer to stand on the roof or on the floor. Few are they who dare to stand in the empty space between. Family. If you want to find Dharma, it has nothing to do with the forest or the mountains or the caves. It's only the heart, and it has its own language of experience. There's a great difference between concepts and direct experience. With a glass of hot water, whoever puts his finger into it will have the same experience, hot, which can be expressed in many different words as there are different languages. Similarly, whoever looks deeply into the heart will have the same experience, no matter what his nationality, culture, or language may be. If in your heart you come to that taste of truth, of Dhamma, then you become like one big family, like mother and father, sisters and brothers, because you've tasted that essence of the heart, which is the same for all. Fertilizer. Our defilements are like fertilizer for our practice. It's the same as taking filthy stuff like chicken manure and buffalo dung to fertilize our fruit trees, so the fruit will be sweet and abundant. In suffering, there is happiness. In confusion, there is calm. Fire. Nothing happens immediately, so in the beginning, we can't see any results from our practice. This is like the example I have often given you of the man who tries to make fire by rubbing two sticks together. They say there's fire here, he says, looking at his sticks. He then begins rubbing energetically. He rubs on and on, but soon becomes impatient. He wants to have that fire, but the fire just won't come. So he gets discouraged and stops to rest for a while. When he starts again, the initial heat that he had worked up has already been lost, so the going is slow. He just doesn't keep at it long enough. He rubs and rubs until he is tired and then stops altogether. Not only is he tired, but he becomes more and more discouraged. There is no fire here, he finally decides and gives up completely. Actually, he was doing the work, but there wasn't enough heat to start the fire. The fire was there all the time, but he didn't carry on to the end. Likewise, with the mind. Until we are able to reach peace, the mind will continue in its confusion. For this reason, the teacher says, just keep on doing it. Keep on with the practice. Maybe we think, if I don't yet understand, how can I do it? Until we are able to practice properly, wisdom won't arise. So we just say, keep on with it. Fish. We don't want desire, but if there is no desire, why practice? We must have desire to practice. Buddha had desire too. It's there all the time, but it's only a condition of the mind. Those with wisdom, however, have desire but no attachment. Our desires are like catching a big fish in a net. We must wait until the fish loses strength, and then we can catch it easily. But all the time we must keep on watching it so that it doesn't escape. Fish and frog. If you attach to the senses, you're the same as a fish caught on a hook. When the fisherman comes, you can struggle all you want, but you won't be able to get loose. Actually, you're not caught like a fish, but more like a frog. A frog gulps down the whole hook right to its guts. A fish just gets caught in its mouth. Fish trap. If you see clearly the harm and the benefit of something, you won't have to wait for others to tell you about it. Consider the story of the fisherman who finds something in his fish trap. He knows something is in it because he can hear it flopping about inside. Thinking it's a fish, he reaches his hand into the trap, only to grab hold of a different kind of animal. He can't see it, so he's not sure what it is. It could be an eel, but it could also be a snake. If he throws it away, he may regret it, for if it turns out to be an eel, he'll have lost something nice for dinner. On the other hand, if he keeps on holding to it, and it turns out to be a snake, it may bite him. He's just not sure. But his desire is so strong that he holds on, just in case it's an eel. The minute he brings it out and sees that it's a snake, however, he doesn't hesitate to fling it away from himself. He doesn't have to wait for someone to call out, "Hey, it's a snake, let go." The sight of the snake tells him what to do more clearly than words could ever do. Why? Because he sees the danger. Snakes can bite and make you very sick or kill you. Who has to tell him about that?
In the same way, if we practice until we see things as they are, we won't meddle with things that are harmful. Fisherman. Our practice of contemplation will lead us to understanding. Let us take the example of a fisherman pulling in his net with a big fish in it. How do you think he feels when pulling it in? If he's afraid the fish will escape, he'll rush and start to struggle with the net, grabbing and tugging at it. In this way, before he knows it, the big fish will have escaped. The fisherman mustn't try too hard. In the olden days, they taught we should do it gradually, carefully gathering it in without losing it. This is how it is in our practice. We gradually feel our way with it, carefully gathering it without losing it. Sometimes it happens that we don't feel like practicing. Maybe we don't want to look, or maybe we don't want to know, but we keep on with it. We continue feeling for it. This is the practice. If we feel like doing it, we do it. If we don't feel like doing it, we do it the same. We just keep on doing it. If we are enthusiastic about our practice, the power of our faith will give energy to what we are doing. But at this stage, we are still without wisdom. Even though we are very energetic, we will not derive much benefit from our practice. We may continue with it for a long time, and a feeling will arise that we are not going to find the way. We may feel that we cannot find peace, or that we are not sufficiently equipped to do the practice. Or maybe we feel that this way just isn't possible anymore. So we give up. At this point, we must be very, very careful. We must use patience and endurance. It's just like pulling in the big fish. We gradually feel our way with it. We carefully pull it in. The struggle won't be too difficult, so we continue to pull it in without stopping. Eventually, after some time, the fish becomes tired and stops fighting, and we're able to catch it easily. Usually, this is how it happens. We practice gradually and carefully, gathering it together. It's in this manner that we do our contemplation. Flashlight. In Buddhism, we are endlessly hearing about letting go and about not clinging to anything. What does this mean? It means to take hold of, but not to cling. Take this flashlight, for example. We wonder, what is this? So we pick it up. Oh, it's a flashlight. Then we put it down again. We take hold of things, even of wanting, in this way. If we didn't take hold of wanting, what could we do? We couldn't do walking meditation or anything else. It's wanting, yes, a defilement, that's true, but later on leads us to perfection. So we must take hold of things first. It is like coming here. First you had to want to come here. If you didn't want to, you wouldn't be here today. We do things because of wanting, but when wanting arises, we don't cling to it, just like we didn't cling to that flashlight. What's this? We picked it up. Oh, it's a flashlight. We then put it down again. This is what holding but not clinging means. We know and then we let it go. We don't foolishly cling to things, but we hold them with wisdom and then let them go. Good or bad, we let them all go. Freeway. It is wrong view to go on thinking that we are the sankharas, or that we are happiness and unhappiness. Seeing like this is not full, clear knowledge of the true nature of things. The truth is that we can't force things to follow our desires. They follow the way of nature. A simple comparison is this. Suppose you go and sit in the middle of a freeway with the cars and trucks speeding down toward you. You can't get angry at the cars, shouting, "Don't drive over here! Don't drive over here!" It's a freeway. You can't tell them that. So what can you do? You get off the road. The road is the place where cars run. If you don't want the cars to be there, you suffer. It's the same with sankharas. We say they disturb us. Like when we sit in meditation and hear a sound, we think, "Oh, that sound's bothering me." If we understand the sound bothers us, then we suffer accordingly. If we investigate a little deeper, we will see that it's we who go out and disturb the sound. The sound is simply sound. If we understand it in this way, then there's nothing more to do. We leave it the sound alone, We see that the sound is one thing and we are another. This is real knowledge of the truth. We see both sides, so we have peace. If we see only one side, there is suffering. Once we see both sides, then we follow the middle way. This is the right practice of the mind. This is what we call straightening out our understanding. In the same way, impermanence and death are the nature of all sankharas, but we don't want it that way. We carry them about and covet them. We want them to be true. We want to find truth within the things that aren't true. Whenever someone sees like this and clings to the sankharas as being himself, he suffers. The Buddha told us to contemplate this. Frog. The more you neglect the practice, the more you neglect going to the monastery to listen to the teachings, the more your mind will sink down into a bog, like a frog going into a hole. Later, when someone comes along with a hook, the frog's days are over. He doesn't have a chance. All he can do is stretch out his neck and be caught. So watch out you don't back yourself up into a hole. Someone may just come along with a hook and pull you up. At home, being pestered by your children and grandchildren and possessions, you're even worse off than the frog. You don't know how to detach from them. When old age, sickness, and death come along, what will you do? This is the hook that's going to catch you. Which way will you turn? Fruit tree. When a fruit tree is in bloom, a strong gust of wind will blow some of its blossoms to the ground. Those that don't fall will eventually grow into small green fruit, but then another gust comes and some of them will fall too. As for the rest, they will grow to become fruit nearly ripe, or even fully ripe, before they fall. And so it is with people. Like flowers and fruit in the wind, they too fall in different stages of life. Some people die while still in the womb, others within only a few days after birth. Some people live for a few years, then die, never having reached maturity. Men and women die in their youth. Still others reach a ripe old age before they die. When reflecting upon people, consider the nature of fruit in the wind. Both are uncertain. Our minds are also similar. A mental impression arises, draws and blows at the mind, then the mind falls, just like the fruit. The Buddha understood this uncertain nature of things. He observed the phenomena of fruit in the wind, and reflected upon the monks and novices who were his disciples. He found that they too were essentially of the same nature, uncertain. How could it be otherwise? This is just the way of all things. Garbage fit. If your mind becomes quiet and concentrated, it is an important tool to use. But if you're sitting just to get concentrated so you can feel happy and pleasant, then you're wasting your time. The practice is to sit and let your mind become still and concentrated. Then use that quiet concentration to examine the nature of the mind and body. If you make the mind simply quiet with no investigation, however, then for that time it's peaceful and there is no defilement. But that is like taking a stone and covering up a smelly garbage pit. When you take the stone away, it's still full of smelly garbage. You must use your concentration, not to attain temporary bliss, but to accurately examine the nature of the mind and body. This is what actually frees you. Gift. We should investigate the body within the body. Whatever's in the body, go ahead and look at it. If we just see the outside, it's not clear. We see hair, nails, and so on, and they are just pretty things which entice us. So the Buddha taught us to look at the inside of the body, to see the body within the body. What is in the body? Look closely and see. We will see many things inside that will surprise us, because even though they are within us, we've never seen them. Whenever we go, we carry them with us, but we still don't know them at all. It's as if we go and visit some relatives at their house and they give us a gift. We take it and put it in our bag and then leave without opening it to see what's inside. When at last we open it, we find it's full of poisonous snakes. Our body is like that. If we just see the shell of it, we say it's fine and beautiful. We forget ourselves. We forget impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, and not self. If we look within this body, it's really repulsive. There's nothing beautiful in it. If we look according to reality without trying to sugar things over, we'll see that it's really sad and wearisome. Dispassion will then arise. This feeling of disinterest is not that we feel aversion for the world. It's simply our mind clearing up, our mind letting go. We see all things as not being substantial or dependable, however we want them to be. They just go their own way, regardless. Things which are unstable are unstable. Things which are not beautiful are not beautiful. So the Buddha said that when we experience sights, sounds, tastes, smells, bodily feelings, or mental states, we should let them go. Whether happiness or unhappiness, they're all the same, so let them go.
Grass. You must contemplate in order to find peace. What people usually mean whenever they say peace is only the calming down of the mind and not the calming down of the defilements. Defilements are simply being temporarily subdued, just like the grass being covered by a stone. If you take the stone away, the grass will grow back again in a short time. The grass hadn't really died, it was just being suppressed. It's the same when sitting in meditation. The mind is calm, but the defilements are not really calm. Therefore, samadhi is not a sure thing. To find real peace, you must develop wisdom. Samadhi is one kind of peace, like the stone covering the grass. This is only a temporary peace. The peace of wisdom is like putting the stone down and just leaving it there. In this way, the grass can't possibly grow back again. This is real peace, the calming of the defilements, the sure peace, which results from wisdom. Hand. Those who study theory and those who practice meditation misunderstand each other. Usually, those who emphasize study say things like, "Monks who only practice meditation just follow their own opinions. They have no basis in their teaching." Actually, in one sense, these two ways of study and practice are exactly the same thing. We can understand this better if we consider the front and back of our hand. If we hold our hand out, it seems like the back of our hand has disappeared. Actually, the back of our hand hasn't gone anywhere. It's just hidden underneath. When we turn our hand over, the same thing happens to the palm of the hand. It doesn't go anywhere, it's merely hidden underneath. We should keep this in mind when we consider practice. If we think that it has disappeared, we'll go off to study, hoping to get results. But it doesn't matter how much you study about Dhamma, you'll never understand because you won't know in accordance with the truth. If we do understand the real nature of Dhamma, then we begin to let go. This is surrendering, removing attachment, not clinging anymore. Or if there is still clinging, it diminishes as time goes by. So study and practice are really just two sides of the same hand. Whole. At times it may seem to some of you that I contradict myself when I teach, but the way I teach is very simple. It is as if I see someone coming down a road he isn't familiar with, but which I have traveled on many times before. I look up and see him about to fall into a hole on the right-hand side of the road, so I call out to him to go left. Likewise, if I see someone else about to fall into a hole on the left, I call out to him to go right. The instructions are different, but I teach them to travel in the same direction on the same road. I teach them to let go of both extremes and come back to the center, where they will arrive at the true Dhamma. House. All my disciples are like my children. I have only loving kindness for them and care for their welfare. If I appear to make you suffer, it is for your own good. I know some of you are well educated and very knowledgeable. People with little education and worldly knowledge can practice easily, but people with a lot of knowledge are like someone who has a very large house to clean. They have a lot to do, but when their house has been cleaned, they will have a big, comfortable living space. In the meantime, be patient. Patience and endurance are essential to our practice. Housewife. Don't be like a housewife washing the dishes with a scowl on her face. She's so intent on cleaning the dishes that she doesn't realize her own mind is dirty. Have you ever seen this? She only sees the dirty dishes. She's looking too far away from herself, isn't she? Some of you have probably experienced this, I'd say. This is where you have to look. People concentrate on cleaning the dishes, but they let their minds go dirty. This is not good. They're forgetting themselves. Jackal. The Buddha and his disciples once saw a jackal run out of the forest they were staying in. It stood still for a while, then it ran into the underbrush, and then out again.
Then it ran into a tree hollow, then out again. Then it went into a cave, only to run out again. One minute it stood, and the next it ran. Then it lay down, then it jumped up. The jackal had the mange. When it stood, the mange would eat into its skin, so it would run. Running, it was still uncomfortable, so it would stop. Standing, it was still uncomfortable, so it would lie down. Then it would jump up again, running to the underbrush, the tree hollow, never staying still. The Buddha said, "Monks, did you see that jackal this afternoon? Standing, it suffered. Running, it suffered. Sitting, it suffered. Lying down, it suffered. It blamed standing for its discomfort. It blamed sitting. It blamed running and lying down. It blamed the tree, the underbrush, the cave. In fact, the problem was with none of those things. The problem was with his mange. We are just the same as that jackal. Our discontent is due to wrong view. Because we don't exercise sense restraint, we blame our suffering on externals. Whether we live in Thailand, America, or England, we aren't satisfied. Why not? Because we still have wrong view. Just that. So wherever we go, we aren't content. But just as that jackal would be content wherever it went as soon as its mange was cured, so would we be content whenever we went once we rid ourselves of wrong view. Knife. A knife has a blade, a spine, and a handle. Can you lift up only the blade? Can you lift up only the spine of the blade, or only the handle? The handle, the spine, and the blade are all parts of the same knife. When you pick up the knife, all three parts come up at the same time. In the same way, if you pick up that which is good, the bad must follow. People search for goodness and try to throw away evil, but they don't study that which is neither good nor evil. If you don't study this, then you won't have real understanding. If you pick up goodness, badness follows. If you pick up happiness, suffering follows. Train the mind until it is above good and evil. That's when the practice is finished.
Not. We contemplate happiness and unhappiness as uncertain and impermanent and understand that all the various feelings we experience are not lasting and not to be clung to. We see things in this way because we have wisdom. We understand that things are impermanent according to their own nature. If we have this kind of understanding, it's like taking hold of one strand of a rope, which makes a knot, and pulling it in the right direction. The knot will then loosen and begin to untangle. It'll no longer be so tight and tense. This is similar to understanding that things don't always have to be the way they've always been. Before, we felt that things had to be a certain way, and in so doing, we pulled this knot tighter and tighter. This tightness is suffering. Living that way is very tense. So we loosen the knot a little and relax. Why do we loosen it? Because it's tight. If we don't cling to it, then we can loosen it. It's not a condition that must always be that way. We use the teaching of impermanence as our basis. We see that both happiness and unhappiness are not permanent. We see them as not dependable. There is absolutely nothing that's permanent. With this kind of understanding, we gradually stop believing in the various moods and feelings which come up in our mind. Wrong understanding will decrease in the same degree that we stop believing in them. This is what is meant by undoing the knot. It continues to become looser. Attachment will gradually be uprooted. Ladle. If you just listen to the Dhamma teachings but don't practice, you're like a ladle in a soup pot. The ladle is in the soup pot every day, but it doesn't know the taste of the soup. You must reflect and meditate. Leaking roof. Most of us just talk about practice without having really done it. This is like the man whose roof is leaking on one side so that he sleeps on the other side of the house. When the sunshine comes in on that side, he rolls over to the other side all the time thinking, "When will I ever get a decent house like everyone else?" If the whole roof leaks, then he just gets up and leaves. This is not the way to do things, but that's how most people are. Leaves. Right now, we are sitting in a peaceful forest. Here, if there's no wind, the leaves remain still. When a wind blows, they flap and flutter. The mind is the same. When it contacts a mental impression, it too flaps and flutters, according to the nature of that mental impression. And the less we know of Dhamma, the more the mind will constantly pursue mental impressions, feeling happy, except
succumbs to happiness. Feeling suffering, it succumbs to suffering. It's in a constant flap.
Letter. Just know what is happening in your mind. Not happy or sad about it, not attached. If you suffer, see it, know it, and be empty. It's like a letter. You have to open it before you can know what's in it.
Log. If we cut a log of wood and throw it into a river, it floats downstream. If that log doesn't rot or get stuck on one of the banks of the river, it will finally reach the ocean. Likewise, the mind that practices the middle way and doesn't attach to either extreme of sensual indulgence or self-mortification will inevitably attain true peace. The log in our analogy represents the mind. The banks of the river represent, on one side, love, on the other side, hate. Or you can say that one bank is happiness and the other unhappiness. To follow the middle way is to see love, hate, happiness, and unhappiness for what they really are, only feelings. Once this understanding has been achieved, the mind will not easily drift toward them and get caught. It is the practice of the understanding mind not to nurture any feelings that rise, nor cling to them. The mind that freely flows down the river unharmed and eventually flows into the ocean of Nibbana.
Lumber. If you don't bother to train your heart, then it remains wild, following the ways of nature. It's possible to train that nature, however, so that it can be used to advantage. This is comparable to trees. If we just left trees in their natural state, then we would never be able to build a house with them. We couldn't make planks or anything to use to build a house with. However, if a carpenter came along wanting to build a house, he would go looking for trees in their natural state. He would take raw material and use it to advantage. In a short time, he could have a house built. Meditation and developing the heart are similar to this. You must take this natural, untrained heart as you would take a tree in its natural state in the forest, and train it so that it is more refined, more aware of itself, and more sensitive.
Maggot. Contentment doesn't depend on how many people we are with. It comes only from right view. If we have right view, then wherever we stay, we are content. But most of us have wrong view. It's just like a maggot living in a pile of dung. It lives in filth. Its food is filth. But it suits the maggot. If you take a stick and dislodge it from its lump of dung, it'll squirm and wriggle back to its home. We are the same. The teacher advises us to see rightly, but we squirm about and are uncomfortable. We quickly run back to our old habits and views because that's where we feel at home. If we don't see the harmful consequences of all our wrong views, then we can't leave them. The practice is difficult, so we should listen. There is nothing else to practice. If we have right view, then wherever we go, we are content.
Mango. We say that morality, concentration, and wisdom are the path on which all the noble ones have walked to enlightenment. They are all one. Morality is concentration. Concentration is morality. Concentration is wisdom. Wisdom is concentration. It's like a mango. When it's a flower, we call it a flower. When it becomes a fruit, we call it a mango. When it ripens, we call it a ripe mango. It's all one mango, but it continually changes. The big mango grows from the small mango. The small mango becomes a big one. You can call them different fruit or all one. Morality, concentration, and wisdom are related like this. In the end, it's all that path that leads to enlightenment. The mango, from the moment it first appears as a flower, simply grows to ripeness. We should see it like this. Whatever others call it, it doesn't matter. Once it's born, it grows to old age, and then where? We should contemplate this. Some people don't want to be old. When they get old, they become regretful. These people shouldn't eat ripe mangoes. Why do we want the mangoes to be ripe? If they're not ripe in time, we ripen them artificially, don't we? But when we become old, we're filled with regret. Some people cry. They're afraid to get old or die. If it's like this, then they shouldn't eat ripe mangoes. They'd better just eat the flowers. If we can see this, then we can see the Dhamma. Everything clears up and we are at peace.
Medicines and fruit. Those who don't practice, don't be angry with them. Don't speak against them, just continually advise them. They will come to the Dhamma when their spiritual factors are developed. It's like selling medicines. We advertise our medicines, and those with a headache or stomach ache will come and take some. Those who don't want our medicines, let them be. They're like fruit that are still green. We can't force them to be ripe and sweet. Just let them be. Let them grow up, sweeten, and ripen all by themselves. If we think like this, our minds will be at ease. So we don't need to force anybody. Simply advertise our medicines and leave it at that. When someone is ill, he'll come around and buy some. Merchants. Everything that you do, you must do with clarity and awareness. When you see clearly, there will no longer be any need for enduring or forcing yourself. You have difficulties and are burdened because you miss the point. Peace comes from doing things completely with your whole body and mind. Whatever is left undone leaves you with a feeling of discontent. These things bind you with worry wherever you go. You want to complete everything, but it's impossible to get it all done. Take the case of the merchants who regularly come here to see me. They say, "Oh, when my debts are all paid and property in order, I'll come to get ordained." They talk like that, but will they ever finish and get it all in order? There's no end to it. They pay off their debts with another loan. They pay off that one and do it again. A merchant thinks that when he gets rid of all his debts, he will be happy. But there's no end to paying things off. That's the way worldliness fools us. We go around and around like this, never realizing our predicament. Oil and water. Oil and water are different in the same way that a wise man and an ignorant man are different. The Buddha lived with form, sound, odor, taste, touch, and thought. He was an arahant, so he was able to turn away from them rather than toward them. He turned away and let go little by little, since he understood that his heart is just the heart and thought is just thought. He didn't confuse them and mix them together. The heart is just the heart. Thoughts and feelings are just thoughts and feelings. Let things be as they are. Let form be just form. Let sound be just sound. Let thought be just thought. Why should we bother to attach to them? If we feel and think in this way, then there is detachment and separateness. Our thoughts and feelings will be on one side and our heart will be on the other. Just like oil and water, they are in the same bottle, but they are separate. Orphan. In the end, people become neurotic. Why? Because they don't know. They just follow their moods and don't know how to look after their own minds. When the mind has no one to look after it, it's like a child without a mother or a father to take care of him. An orphan has no refuge, and without a refuge, he is very insecure. Likewise, if the mind is not looked after, if there is no training or maturation of character with right understanding, it's really troublesome. Ox cart. Suppose we had a cart and an ox to pull it. The wheels of the cart aren't long, but the tracks are. As long as the ox pulls the cart, the tracks will follow. The wheels are round, yet the tracks are long. Just looking at the stationary cart, one couldn't see anything long about the wheels, but once the ox starts pulling the cart, we see the tracks stretching out behind. As long as the ox keeps pulling, the wheels keep turning. But there comes a day when the ox gets tired and throws off its yoke. The ox walks off and the cart is left there. The wheels no longer turn. In time, the cart falls apart. Its constituent parts go back into the four elements of earth, water, wind, and fire. People who follow the world are the same. If one were to look for peace within the world, one would go on and on without end, just like the wheels of the cart. As long as we follow the world, there is no stopping, no rest. If we simply stop following it, the wheels of the cart no longer turn. They are stopping right there. Following the world ceaselessly, the tracks go on. Creating bad karma is like this. As long as we continue to follow the old ways, there is no stopping. If we stop, then there is stopping. This is the practice of Dhamma. Pool. Be mindful and let things take their natural course. Then your mind will become quiet in any surroundings. It will become still like a clear forest pool, and all kinds of wonderful and rare animals will come to drink from it. Then you will clearly see the nature of all things in the world. You will see many wonderful and strange things come and go, but you will be still. This is the happiness of the Buddha. Rain water. Actually, the mind, like rainwater, is pure in its natural state. If we were to drop green dye into clear rainwater, however, it would turn green. If yellow dye were added, it would turn yellow. The mind reacts similarly. When a comfortable mental impression drops into the mind is comfortable. When the mental impression is uncomfortable, the mind is uncomfortable. The mind becomes cloudy, like the colored water. When clear water contacts yellow, it turns yellow. When it contacts green, it turns green. It will change color every time. Actually, the water which turned green or yellow is naturally clean and clear. This is also the natural state of the mind, clean and pure and unconfused. It becomes confused only because it pursues mental impressions. It gets lost in its moods. River flow. There's nothing wrong with the way the body grows old and gets sick. It just follows its nature. So it's not the body that causes us suffering, but our own wrong thinking. When we see the right wrongly, there's bound to be confusion. It's like the water of a river. It naturally flows downhill. It never flows uphill. That's its nature. If we were to go and stand on the bank of a river and seeing the water flowing swiftly down its course, foolishly want it to flow back uphill, we would suffer. We would suffer because of our wrong view, our thinking against the stream. If we had right view, we would see that the water must flow downhill. Until we realize and accept this fact, we will always be agitated and never find peace of mind. The river that must flow downhill is like our body. It passes through youth, old age, and finally dies. Don't let us go wishing it were otherwise. It's not something we have the power to remedy. Don't go against the stream. Road. Wherever you are, know yourself by being natural and watchful. If doubts arise, let them come and go. When you meet defilements, just see them and overcome them by letting go of them. It's very simple. Hold on to nothing. It's as though you're walking down a road. Periodically, you will run into obstacles. When you meet defilements, just see them and overcome them by letting go of them. Don't think about the obstacles you have already passed. Don't worry about the obstacles you have not yet met. Stick to the present. Don't be concerned about the length of the road or about your destination. Everything is changing. Whatever you pass, do not cling to it. Eventually, the mind will reach its natural balance. Then it will be still, whether you sit with your eyes closed or walk around in a big city. Rock. The teaching that people least understand and which conflicts most with their own opinions is the teaching of letting go or working with the empty mind. When we conceive this in worldly terms, we become confused and think that we can do anything we want. It can be interpreted in this way, but its real meaning is closer to this. It's as if we were carrying a heavy rock. After a while, we begin to feel its weight, but we don't know how to let it go. So we endure this heavy burden all the time. If someone came along and told us to throw it away, we'd say, "But if I throw it away, I won't have anything left." Even if told of all the benefits to be gained by throwing it away, we would still refuse to do so, for fear of being left with nothing. So we keep on carrying this heavy rock until it becomes so unbearably heavy, and we become so weak and exhausted that we just have to drop it. Having dropped it, we suddenly experience the benefits of letting go. We immediately feel better and lighter, and we know for ourselves how much of a burden carrying a rock can be. Before we let go of the rock, we couldn't possibly know the benefits of letting go. Later on, we may start carrying burdens again. But now we know what the results will be, so we can now let go more easily. This understanding that it's useless carrying burdens around and that letting go brings ease and lightness is an example of knowing ourselves. Our pride, our sense of self that we depend on, is the same as that heavy rock. Like that rock, if we think about letting go of the self, we are afraid that without it, there would be nothing left. But when we finally can let go, we realize for ourselves the ease and comfort of not clinging. Screw. If you clearly see the truth through meditation, then suffering will become unwound, just like a screw. When you unwind a screw, it withdraws. It's not tightly fixed as when you screw it clockwise. The mind withdraws like this. It lets go. It relinquishes. It's not tightly bound within good and evil, within possessions, praise and blame, happiness or suffering. If we don't know the truth, it's like tightening the screw all the time. You screw it down until it crushes you and you suffer over everything. When you unwind out of all that, you become free and be at peace. Seedling. In meditation, you must continuously be attentive, just like when planting a seedling. If you plant a seedling in one place, then after 3 days, you pull it up and plant it in another place. And after 3 more days, pull it up again and plant it somewhere else. It will just die and not grow up and bear any fruit. Meditation is the same. If you do a 7-day meditation retreat and after leaving it for 7 months go around soiling the mind, then come back and do another 7-day retreat where you don't speak and you keep to yourself, it's like the tree. Your meditation practice won't be able to grow and it will die without producing any real results. Sharp knife. When we say that the mind stops, we mean that it feels as if it stopped, that it does not go running about here and there. It's as if we have a sharp knife. If we go and indiscriminately cut away at things like stones, bricks, and glass, our knife will quickly become blunt. We must cut only things which are useful to cut. Our mind is the same. If we let our mind wander after thoughts or feelings which have no use or value, the mind will become weak because it has no chance to rest. If the mind has no energy, wisdom will not arise, because the mind without energy is a mind without concentration. Snake. People want happiness, not suffering. But in fact, happiness is just a refined form of suffering. Suffering itself is the coarse form. We can compare them to a snake. The snake's head is unhappiness. The snake's tail is happiness. The snake's head is really dangerous, for it has the poisonous fangs. If we touch it, the happiness will bite us right away. But never mind the head. Even if we go and take hold the tail, the snake will turn around and bite us just the same, because both the head and tail belong to the one snake. Likewise, happiness and unhappiness, pleasure and sadness, arise from the same snake, wanting. So when we're happy, the mind isn't really peaceful. For example, when we get things we like, such as wealth, prestige, praise, or happiness, we become pleased, but the mind remains uneasy for fear of losing them. That very fear isn't a peaceful state. Later, we may really lose things, and then we truly suffer. So if we're not aware, even when happy, suffering is imminent. It's just like grabbing the snake's tail. If we don't let go, the snake will bite. So be it, the snake's tail or head, that is, wholesome or unwholesome conditions, they're all just characteristics of the wheel of existence, of endless change. Spider. Watching a spider can give rise to wisdom. A spider spins its web in any convenient niche and then sits in the center, staying still. Later, a fly comes along and lands on its web. As soon as the fly touches and shakes the web, boop, the spider pounces on it and winds it up in thread. It stores the insect away and then returns again to collect itself silently in the center of its web. This is not at all different from our own mind. Our mind is comparable to the spider, and our moods and mental impressions to the various insects. The senses constantly stimulate the mind. When any of them contacts something, it immediately reaches the mind. The mind then investigates and examines it thoroughly, after which it returns to the center. Coming to the center means living mindfully with clear comprehension, being always alert and doing everything with precision. This is our center. There's really not a lot for us to do. We just carefully live in this way. But that doesn't mean that we live heedlessly, thinking that we don't need to do any sitting or walking meditation and so forget all about our practice. We must remain alert like the spider waiting to snatch up insects for its food. This is how we abide, alert, acting with precision, and always mindfully comprehending with wisdom. Still flowing water. Have you ever seen flowing water? Have you ever seen still water? If your mind is peaceful, it will be just like still flowing water. Have you ever seen still flowing water? There! You've only seen flowing water or still water, haven't you? When your mind is peaceful, you can develop wisdom. Your mind will be like flowing water and yet still. It's almost as if it were still and yet it's flowing. so I call it still, flowing water. Wisdom can arise here. Sweet fruit. Even though a fruit is sweet, we must first taste it before we know what its flavor is really like. Yet, that fruit, even though no one tastes it, is still sweet. But nobody knows it. The Dhamma of the Buddha is like that. Even though it's the truth, it isn't true for those who don't really know it. No matter how excellent or fine it may be, it is worthless to them. Thermos bottle. Read yourself, not books. Truth isn't outside. That's only memory, not wisdom. Memory without wisdom is like an empty thermos bottle. If you don't fill it, it's useless. Thirsty man. A man comes walking along a road. He is very thirsty from his journey and is craving for a drink of water. He stops at a place beside the road and asks for a drink. The owner of the water says, "You can drink this water if you like. The color is good and the smell is good. The taste is good too. But if you drink it, you will become ill. It'll make you sick enough to die or nearly die." The thirsty man does not listen. He's as thirsty as a person after an operation who's been denied a good drink of water for a while. He's crying for water, so he dips out a bit of the water and swallows it down, finding it very tasty. He then drinks his fill and gets so sick that he almost dies. He didn't listen to the warning that was given to him because of his overpowering desire. This is how it is for a person caught in the pleasures of the senses. The Buddha taught that they are poisonous, but he is thirsty and so he doesn't listen. He drinks in sight, sound, smells, tastes, tactile sensations, and mind objects, and they are all delicious. So he drinks without stopping, and there he remains stuck fast until the day he dies. Thorn. All things are just as they are. They don't cause suffering to anybody. It's just like a really sharp thorn. Does it make us suffer? No, it's just a thorn. It doesn't bother or harm anyone. It just minds its own business. But if we go and stand on it, we'll suffer. Why is there suffering? Because we've stepped on the thorn. So it's we ourselves that caused our pain. Form, feeling, perception, volition, consciousness, all the things in the world are simply as they are. It's we who pick fights with them, and if we hit them, they hit us back. If we leave them alone, they leave us alone. Only the foolish man gives them trouble. Trap. The Buddha taught that the objects of the senses are a trap of Maras. It is a hunter's trap, and the hunter is Mara. If animals are caught in a hunter's trap, it's a sorrowful predicament. They are caught fast and are held waiting for the owner of the trap. Have you ever snared birds? The snare springs and, boop, caught by the neck. A good, strong string holds it fast. Wherever the bird flies, it cannot escape. It flies here and flies there, but it's held tight, waiting for the owner of the snare to come. When the hunter comes along, that's it. The bird is struck with fear and there is no escape. The trap of sights, sounds, smells, tastes, touch, and mind objects is the same. They catch us and bind us fast. Traveler. Naturally, people who wish to reach their home are not those who merely sit and think about traveling. They must actually undertake the process of traveling step by step and in the right direction as well in order to finally reach home. If they take the wrong path, they may eventually run into difficulties, such as swamps or other obstacles, which are hard to get around, or they may run into dangerous situations and thereby possibly never reach home. Those who reach home can relax and sleep comfortably. Home is a place of comfort. But if the traveler only passed by the front of his home or walked by around it, he would not receive any benefit from having traveled all the way home. In the same way, walking the path to reach the Buddha Dhamma is something each one of us must do individually ourselves, for no one can do it for us. And we must travel along proper path of morality, concentration, and wisdom until we find the blessings of purity, radiance, and peacefulness of mind that are the fruits of traveling the path. However, if one only has knowledge of books, sermons, and sutras, that is, only knowledge of the map or plans for the journey, even in hundreds of lifetimes, one will never know purity, radiance, and peacefulness of mind. Instead, one will just waste time and never get to the real benefits of practice. Teachers are those who point out the direction of the path. After listening to the teachers, whether or not we walk the path by practicing ourselves and thereby reap the fruits of practice is strictly up to each one of us. Trees. We can learn Dhamma from trees. A tree is born due to a cause, and it grows following the course of nature until it buds, flowers, and bears fruit. Right here, the tree is discoursing Dhamma to us, but we don't understand it. We're unable to bring it within and contemplate, so we don't know that the tree is teaching us Dhamma. The fruit appears, and we merely eat it without investigating. Sweet, sour, or bitter, it's the nature of the fruit, and this is Dhamma, the teaching of the fruit. Then the leaves grow old. They wither, die, and fall from the tree. All we see is that the leaves have fallen down. We step on them. We sweep them up. That's all. We don't know that nature is teaching us. Later on, the new leaves sprout, and we merely see that without taking it further. This is not the truth. That is known through internal reflection. If we can bring all this inward and investigate it, we will see that the birth of a tree and our own birth are no different. This body of ours is born and exists, dependent on conditions, on the elements of earth, water, wind, and fire. Every part of the body changes according to its nature. Hair, nails, teeth, and skin all change, just as every part of the tree does. If we know the things of nature, then we will know ourselves. Turtle. Looking for peace is like looking for a turtle with a mustache. You won't be able to find it, but when your heart is ready, it will come looking for you. Twigs and root. As soon as we're born, we're dead. Our birth and our death are just one thing. It's like a tree. When there are twigs, there must be a root. When there's a root, there must be twigs. You can't have one without the other. It's a little funny to see how at death people are so grief-stricken, and at birth so delighted. I think if you really want to cry, then it would be better to do so when someone's born, for actually birth is death. Death is birth. The root is the twig. The twig is the root. If you've got to cry, cry at the root. Cry at the birth. Look closely and see. If there was no birth, there would be no death.